Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
512 points down on the Dow today. Good thing we got that debt deal, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. And by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the Internet and stopping unwanted email. Reputation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 4th of August. Good to have you with us. And here's the thing about today. This was the kind of market day everybody was expecting if we didn't get a debt deal. Yet, a deal we do have. So maybe without squabbling politicians dominating the news, investors actually had underlying economic challenges to fret about on this Thursday. Wall Street has managed to remain fairly darn bullish, all things considered. And then today, we woke up to European markets in a swoon over Spain and Italy and the ever-increasing debt spiral in the Eurozone. And all bets were off. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith went in search of the what the heck's going on.
Double-digit unemployment, soaring gas prices, sluggish economic growth, debt crises in Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Italy, Spain, the debt ceiling. Through it all, the stock market kept climbing. And that never seemed quite right to investment manager Michael Farr.
To have rebounded 90% from the lows in 2009 just seemed to be a little too neat a solution to one of the most devastating economic disasters in history.
Europe's troubles are nothing new, but they're back in focus, not to mention all of the publicity the debt ceiling debate gave to our precarious financial situation. That combo seems to have made investors suddenly question the buying binge, says Georgetown finance professor James Angel.
Much like Wile E. Coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons, sometimes the stock market will be on such a trajectory that it runs off a cliff, doesn't realize it's run off a cliff, until it looks down and suddenly goes, oops, and the market corrects itself.
What made the markets look down? Jack Ablin is chief investment officer for Harris Private Bank. He says U.S. growth is slowing, and it appears Wall Street's knight in shining armor, Uncle Sam, might not be able to ride to the rescue this time.
There's a growing sense that countervailing forces from the Fed just won't be there, and we're going to end up suffering the next downturn, you know, by gritting our teeth and just having to bear with it.
And Ablin says the one reliable piece of good news, fat company profits, is under threat too. With economies all over the world facing headwinds, companies will have a harder time selling their products, which is, after all, how they make those profits. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The share price specifics of today's markets we'll get to in due course, but one blue chip valiantly swam against the tide most of the day, trying in vain, it turned out, to stay positive. Shares of Kraft, maker of cookies and comfort food, dropped a relatively tolerable 1.5% today, not so bad when you get right down to it. The company said this morning it's going to split itself in two, one part making snacks like Oreos, the other making real food like mac and cheese. Our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore, explains why Wall Street usually likes it when big companies can't quite keep things together.
If you've ever eaten a big bowl of mac and cheese followed by a gooey chocolate bar, you know that they don't go so well together. People who held shares of Kraft also got a stomach ache after the company acquired Cadbury. Now, only 18 months later, Kraft realizes that the sweet part of its business is growing fast and the grocery part is growing slowly. So investors want them on separate plates. But already?
Markets used to be more patient. Today, the markets are very impatient.
That's Robert Profusik. He's a lawyer with Jones Day, who's a hardened veteran of mergers and breakups. He says investors are putting corporate executives under more pressure to keep their stock price strong or risk losing their jobs. But shareholders don't usually like sprawling companies. For every part of a big company they like, there's a part they're not happy with. So they slap a discount on the stock price, about 10 to 15%. A breakup makes those companies quick and nimble. Investors pay a premium for that, says Anant Sundaram. He's a professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
The stock price impact of breakups is very, very positive breakups create substantial value to the point where you begin to wonder why don't companies break up all the time.
And it just so happens, companies do seem to be breaking up all the time this year. The business section of the newspaper looks like a copy of Us Weekly, except instead of J-Lo and her husband, it's ITT, Motorola, Sara Lee, McGraw-Hill, ConocoPhillips. But that's not unusual, says Profusik.
There's not any permanence in the corporate world.
A big bonus, of course, is that these splits happen to be tax-free. So unlike those divorces you read about in Us Weekly, these breakups are relatively cheap. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
The United Nations has taken its first real action against the Syrian government. 5 months after protests started there, yesterday, the UN condemned, that's their word, the government in Damascus and announced economic sanctions. Opposition leaders, though, say that's not enough. They want the international community to do more to cut off Syria's sizable oil revenues. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Osama Manajid is a leading Syrian dissident in London. His take on yesterday's UN Security Council condemnation of the Assad regime?
Too little, too late. We were just watching another Rwanda, therefore another Serbia now in front of our eyes.
Manajid argues that cutting off Syrian oil exports would hurt the government.
That generates between $7 to $8 million a day for them. And that money is being used to buy bullets and kill protesters.
Here in the U.S., 67 senators support energy sanctions. So does the ambassador to Syria. But Americans don't buy Syrian oil. Europeans do. And they're talking less tough. Some attribute that to Arab Spring fatigue, political and economic. Others argue oil embargoes don't work. Economist Robin Mills in Dubai remembers the case of Iraq.
Those sanctions were generally considered to be a disaster. Millions of children died from poverty and disease. They were manipulated by the regime, so they just made Saddam Hussein's regime stronger. That was really an example of what should be avoided in Syria.
He says the details of sanctions do matter. And he admits short-term pressure could work with Syria. Robert Dineen at the Council on Foreign Relations says the key is to send an instant message to Syria's business elite.
The goal is political. The goal is to drive a wedge between the regime and its supporters.
The UN Security Council's next meeting on Syria is scheduled for next week. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Friend of mine said this morning, gee, I can't wait to hear what kind of fictional reasons people are going to come up with for the market collapse today. So I'm not even going to try. We'll have the details and, suffice it to say, the sad music when we do the numbers. Las Vegas is no stranger to shady characters, but there is a veritable plethora in town this week. They're so shady, in fact, they call themselves Black Hats. It's a convention of hackers and cybersecurity researchers who, it turns out, are trying to do good by being bad. Marketplace's Steve Henn is on an all-expenses-paid trip to Vegas for the conference. So, Steve, you having fun yet, man?
Yeah, I am having fun. It's kind of an interesting scene out here. You know, I was registering for this conference, and the guy behind the press desk was like this bearded, tattooed dude, and I asked him if there was a wireless connection I could hook up to, and he just looked at me like I was this lost, pathetic soul and said, you know, man, don't use the wireless. And I was thinking, why not? So I asked, and he said, you're at a hacker convention.
I like that, actually. That's pretty good. He was doing you a favor.
He was. Yeah, I owe him a drink.
Yeah, well, that's an entirely different thing. Beyond the wireless, though, what exactly is going on there?
There's a lot going on. There are a lot of people here who are raising concerns about how interconnected lots of different devices are. So there's this guy named Don Bailey at ISEC Partners, and he's hacked into this device called the Zoomback. Yeah. Here he is at the conference talking about this.
Right.
This is literally just a small consumer tracking device. Nobody knew who the heck this thing was before Oprah went on and said, hey, you know what's really cool? You can track your kids and make sure they're safe. To do that, use this little small device that you can throw in their backpack, and now they're super safe, and you can track them online with Web 2.0 interface. Thumbs up. I heard that and thought, oh dear God, no. Please, Oprah, no. No, Oprah, no.
Yeah. So Don is really good at hacking into the mobile cell phone network. And this device, the Zoomback, basically uses the cell phone network.
Mm.
So he targeted it. He got on the network, looked around, was able to identify these things, could track these devices as they moved around, right? So, like, track your kid.
Yeah.
And then he realized he could spoof them. So he could send fake information about where a device was back to the Zoomback website, which is, if you're a parent, terrifying.
Yeah, obviously not good. What did Zoomback do about it? One guess is he told Zoomback, right?
Yeah, he did. But at first, honestly, they thought he was nuts. It took him a couple months to break through and get in touch with people who actually would address the problem. And eventually they patched it. But as he was doing this research, he realized that Zoomback wasn't the only company out there using mobile phone chips to do this kind of stuff. Home alarms were doing it, car alarms, water treatment facilities, the electric grid. So, you know, all of these devices were vulnerable in the same way.
Let me ask you this, though, Steve. Hackers are guys who work in secret. They wear black hats, as we're told. It's all hush-hush. I don't understand why they're at a big convention in Vegas telling everybody about what they're doing.
Well, the guys giving the talks here generally are the good guys. They're not the people out there stealing your credit card number. And what they're trying to do is alert companies that use these technologies that we have some real weak spots in our security infrastructure, and that if they don't take steps to fix them and spend some money to fix them, they could have problems. You know, the whole idea is to basically spread the word and make us all safer.
And we're doing our part. Marketplace's Steve Henn at the Black Hat Conference out in Las Vegas, Nevada. Steve, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Our book series this summer is premised on a fairly ordinary question. What do you do for a living? We've been asking that of people who do a whole lot of different things. And then we've been following up by asking them what books they might have read that helped them get there. In the case of one CEO, a work of prose helped her turn the page on a career. Here's Jennifer Shanley.
I'm not a big reader of self-help books, but I discovered Rhonda Lichtenberg's book, Pitch Like a Girl, How a Woman Can Be Herself and Still Succeed, while at the bookstore. But first, let me tell you a little bit about myself. I am a designer and creator of video games for girls. I'm a CEO of the company Zwirls, Inc. And I know you may be thinking, video games for girls, do they make those? A lot of people have a stereotype that video games are male and violent. But the games I design are positive, active, social, collaborative games. So back to the book. It's the subtitle that made me buy it. How a woman can be herself and still succeed. And that's really important to me, how to succeed without selling myself out. The author, Ms. Lichtenberg, identifies the differences in what she calls pink, blue, and striped skills and styles, rather than referring to genders. So how did that help me? Well, when I first started this project, I had to convince a team of very blue-styled computer code writers to jump on board with my girly project. And by blue, I mean folks who are a little more analytical and task-focused. And this team had just completed a post-apocalyptic shooting game. Now, that's a far cry from my girl power fun with friends dance game. And they weren't so sure that the market needed games for girls. So I demonstrated that the market was growing by leaps and bounds. I stuck to facts and figures. I showed them the current fashion, makeup, and princess games for girls. And then I gave them a demo of a game aimed at girls that has completely missed the mark. A game offensive on so many levels that you can't help but have an emotional reaction. The premise? To buy as many shoes as possible while using your boyfriend's credit card. They were shocked. And I was able to convince them that my dance game would fill a huge void in the market.
Jennifer Shanley is, as she said, the CEO and founder of Zwirls, Inc. If you've got a book that helped you pick a career, tell us about it. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up,
Then I was ready to go outside into the world with thousands of dollars worth of jewelry strapped to my body.
Just another day in the Diamond District, I guess. But first, mostly because we have to, let's do the numbers. Yeah, I think we need something sadder than the wah-wah trombones. As we mentioned earlier, it was messy on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials took a swan dive down 512 points, 4.3%. Hit the brakes at 11,383. The blue chips finally did. The Dow, by the way, now in the red for the year. Floor also came off. The NASDAQ plunged 136 points, more than 5%, landed at 2556. The S&P 500 tumbled 60 points. That's 4.75%, ended things at 1,200 even. Financials got clobbered. Bank of America retreated nearly 7.5%. Citigroup said goodbye to 6.5%. Wells Fargo galloped down 5.75% today. Not even news of better retail sales in July could hold back the bears on this Thursday. Department store Macy's unraveled more than 6%. Target strayed nearly 4%. Walmart closed the register on a loss of 2.33%. Bond prices soared. People are looking for things to do with all that money they're taking out of stocks. The yield on the 10-year T-note slid to 2.41%. I'm going to say that again. 2.41% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Labor Department releases July's employment report. On the first anniversary of the Chilean mine collapse, the Smithsonian opens its exhibit devoted to the successful rescue of 33 miners. And you too could win one of 5,000 pairs of boxers or briefs from FreshPair.com. Just one way it's celebrating National Underwear Day. I'm Catherine Roberts.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Used to be you got out of college, you got a job, and you went about your merry career-making way. Now it doesn't quite work like that. Internships are where it's at, during college or just afterward. And you're happy to have them, right? All eager, hoping to land that first job. But change your frame of reference for a second. Say you're not just out of school. Say you just got laid off and couldn't find another job. So how does working for free sound? Marketplace's Sean Cole has more now on the changing face of Intern Nation.
I want to tell you about a little company in Indiana called RoundPeg.
We do marketing for small businesses.
Lorraine Ball calls herself creative director.
And it's my company, so I can call myself anything I want.
That's right.
And that's this week's title.
What was last week's title?
Mom. I think I went with Mom last week.
Because most of her staffers are under the age of 26. Which makes sense. The company does a lot of social media work on Twitter and Facebook. As a rule, her interns tend to skew young, too. But after the recession hit, that rule broke.
Probably about 2 or 3 years ago, we started seeing non-traditional interns applying to us.
Non-traditional means older folks, mid-career. RoundPeg gets about 100 internship applications a year, out of which the older applicants make up...
maybe 10%.
10%?
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to people about being interns who are going to actually report to people who are 5 and 10 years their junior. Wow, how's that going to work?
But it did work. Well, she says, particularly with the third older intern she took on. Here she is.
Jennifer Riley Simone.
I just love that name.
Jennifer Riley Simone.
She was a stay-at-home mom for about 14 years, and last fall she wanted to get back into the workforce. She was 41. And how old was the person who trained you to use Twitter and Facebook and all that?
She is 23 or 24 years old.
Jennifer Riley Simone had never even been on Twitter before the internship, and now she has a couple social media clients of her own, grossing her about $40,000 a year.
People will say, oh, I could never go get an internship. I have to make money. And they're out of work. and they're looking for a job and they're not doing anything to make themselves more marketable. And you can spend 20 hours a week in an internship and then spend the other 20 hours a week looking for a job.
Which is what a career counselor will generally tell you these days.
What do you have to lose?
They'll say, especially if they're a career counselor named Karen Pilevsky in New York. About 8 of her last 100 clients or so have gone for it.
1 out of 10, maybe 1 out of 15. So what is that, 10%? Maybe 7 to 10%.
But there aren't any empirical numbers for mid-career interns in the U.S. And yet I read an article about this on the web the other day with the headline, Unpaid Jobs, the New Normal?
I would not call it the new normal whatsoever. Not even close.
Sherry Butler is president of the National Career Development Association.
What would you call it?
A trend that has grown somewhat.
Unpaid jobs, a trend that has grown somewhat.
Are more companies depending on what amounts to free labor now?
I don't think they're depending on it, no. And they can't, actually.
By law, the U.S. Department of Labor issued a directive last year defining what an internship is and isn't. An intern is not to displace an employee. An intern is not entitled to wages or a job at the end of the internship. And most important,
the person, the trainee, the intern, whatever you want to call them, has to benefit more from the experience than the employer.
In other words, by law, internships are all about training the Jennifer Riley Simones of the world.
I definitely got more out of this internship than they did.
And not about helping out employers like Lorraine Ball of Round Peg.
Like, I couldn't bring in an accounting student and call it an internship.
Right.
Because I can't teach, I really can't teach that person anything about accounting. Yeah, no.
And she made a point of saying she doesn't just take on any out-of-work mid-career candidate who walks through the door. There are those who seem like they'd have trouble reporting to a supervisor half their age. In fact, one older prospective intern assumed that all of the young staffers at Round Peg were interns themselves. That person was not invited back. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
The stretch of 47th Street in New York City between 5th and 6th Avenues is unusual for its economic productivity, even in a city that was founded on the very idea of making money. Manhattan's Diamond District is home to 4,000 businesses. They do more than $24 billion worth of buying and selling every year. That comes from a community development report not too long ago, but not everything is all sparkly in the Diamond District. The report also said they need to clean up the buildings on 47th Street, market themselves better, and get younger people into the diamond business. Alicia Oltuski practically grew up in the district, watching her father deal antique diamonds. So her new book, Precious Objects, it's called, is part family memoir, part business insider. Alicia, good to have you with us.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
This is one of those where, regretfully, radio doesn't quite do it justice. I want you to describe for us what the Diamond District in Manhattan looks like. I mean, it's an interesting, interesting place.
The Diamond District in New York is really a world unto itself. There are dealers haggling on the street. There are men and women with signs in their hands and over their chests. And they call out, "We buy gold, we buy diamonds." But at any given time, they're really a multiplicity of languages being spoken on that street. Yiddish in particular enjoys this sort of renaissance there.
Well, that's my memory of it as a kid, is all these old Jewish guys running around.
And that's changing, but you do see very many ultra-Orthodox Jews dressed in black hats and garb.
Yeah, it is being beset by some of the same forces that are affecting the rest of the global economy. There's outsourcing to China and India of diamond cutting. There's the internet. I mean, explain to us what's going on there.
There is a huge pressure for diamond dealers to start trading their merchandise on the internet. And this seems terrifying to people who deal in a commodity that relies so heavily on near invisibilities, really. I was recently talking to my grandfather, who has been in the diamond industry for decades, and he told me that he used to have an inventory in his mind and could remember every single detail of every single stone that he had bought and sold, a cloud on the right side of its table or a little mark on one of its facets.
There's a scene early on in the book, right at the very beginning, in fact, where you undertake your first errand, I suppose you could call it, for your dad, running some diamonds to the other side of the street or something. Tell us that story.
That's right. I had to put on this chest pack. It's this small pouch over one of my shoulders. It sort of lay between my breast and my armpit. Not very comfortable, but that's where it had to be so as not to be too conspicuous. And then I put my jacket back on and my father looked me over. And then I was ready to go outside into the world with thousands of dollars worth of jewelry strapped to my body. And this is something that people do in the district every day. But for me, it drove home the point of just how many jewels and how much value passed through the Diamond District.
And to that point about this being a business based on trust and faith and mutual understanding, the scene where you get to wherever you're going and you say, "Hey, I'm Altolsky," I said to Ginsburg. I mean, it's basically I'm from the guy across the street. You know me, so here's my stuff.
That's right. On the one hand, it makes it rather archaic. On the other hand, I think that this trust is one clue into why it survived so many generations. There are few other industries where so much value changes hands so quickly.
Alicia Altolsky. Her book is called Precious Objects, A Story of Diamonds, Family, and a Way of Life. You can read an excerpt on our book blog. It's at marketplace.org/thebigbook. Alicia, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film Another Earth, an official selection of the 2011 Sundance Film Festival, starring actor and co-writer Britt Marling, now playing. By Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, nobody's giving any details, but there is one small sliver of sanity in Washington today. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced a deal this afternoon that will, at least temporarily, get the Federal Aviation Administration back to work while Congress is on vacation for the month. Details to come tomorrow when whatever the arrangement is becomes official. Then they'll take the whole thing up again in September when they get back. Plus ça change, I think is the phrase you're looking for here. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Thursday. As we mentioned earlier, not a good day in the markets. The Dow down 512 points, about 4.3%. Floor came off the NASDAQ, 136 points down, more than 5%. The S&P 500 gave back 60 points, 4.75%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back on The Big Show, beer, good beer, in a can.
Cans are much better for the beer. Beer doesn't like light, and beer doesn't like oxygen.
Yeah, but cans, come on. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.